comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet, thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on earth. We are here because you matter. We are here because you have a right to know. Comet Elenine, well, it continues to be a hot topic out on the internet. One of the main figures in the dissemination of information about Comet Elenine has been and continues to be Marshall Masters. Within the last 14 days or so, Marshall was here as my guest on the Kevin Smith Show, talking with us about the comet and evidence that suggests it is already affecting us here on Earth. Since that show, he says there is additional evidence that has come in, and he's going to be here tonight to share this new information with us. Now, you need to know this is important. All of you who are members at the Kevin Smith Show are aware of the fact that on the first Saturday of every month, I do a chat. I go into our chat room and spend a couple of hours in chat. Well, this time we're going to do it a little bit different. It will be on the first Saturday of September. That will be September the 3rd. But instead of it being at showtime, we're going to do it at, the times are on the Pacific Coast. It will be at 10 a.m., 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. If you're in the central time zone, that would mean that it would be 2 hours later, so it would be at noon on Saturday the 23rd. If you're on the East Coast, it would mean 1 p.m. your time. Now, why are we doing that? Well, we're doing that because Marshall Masters is going to join us for a video chat. And we haven't had a video chat in some time, so it's a special broadcast inside the members area. You have to be a member to be a part of that, and you can take care of that tonight. Make sure you are a member by joining tonight. It is only 23 cents a day. That's $6.95. And I also want to remind you that we have a brand new members community that's under construction and will open pretty soon. We still have a few little bugs and kinks to work out as we hook up things, but it's getting close to time for us to have our grand opening. Right now, if you pay monthly, it's $6.95 per month. When we open the new members community, that goes up to $7.50 a month. Still a fantastic value. It's got all the same stuff that our current members area has, but it has additional stuff, too. I used to have an English teacher that got on to me about saying stuff all the time. But, it communicates. You understand, don't you? And but if you join right now at $6.95 a month, that you lock that in for a year. It locks that price in for you for a year. So if you join before we have that grand opening, you'll save a bit more money, all right? All right, we're going to step away for a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Marshall Masters about the updated information on Elenine. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Leonid Elenin is a young Russian astronomer, and he discovered a comet. I believe it was in 2010. Now, this comet was headed our direction, and it was named after him. They decided to name it Comet Elenin. Well, since that discovery, Comet Elenin has become the focus of discussion for millions of people. For some, it appears to be a matter of great concern. For NASA, it seems to be an insignificant, according to them, wimpy sort of a comet. Well, my guest tonight is Marshall Masters, and for him, Elenin is a matter of concern. Since appearing on this show a few days ago, more evidence has come, evidence that he wants you to know about. Marshall, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
It's a pleasure to be back, Kevin.
Marshall, before we jump into this, let me say something about interruptions that we get from time to time, and you and I have certainly, in fact, you and I actually caught the wiretap one night. And
that's right.
Yeah. Let me say something about that. Last night we had Walter Bosley on. Walter is formerly U.S. Air Force OSI chief of counter-espionage operations at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And we had him talking with us about these earthquakes, one in Colorado, one in Virginia. And there's a story out there, I'm sure you've seen it, that says these were not earthquakes, these were caused by nuclear blasts in the deep underground tunnels that the U.S. government has. And we were talking about whether that was plausible or not. And he opts for a different scenario, and he began to explain his scenario, which involves Tesla earthquake technology and ley lines, using ley lines. And everything went fine until he started talking about the ley lines. Bam. He got cut off. All right. We got him back on the phone. It took a little bit, but we got him back on the phone. Right at the end of the show, I asked him a question, and bam, he got cut off. And I could not call him. He could not call me. And I got an email from him, and he said, not only were my phones shut down, and I'm not sure what this means, but he said the alarm system in my house was tweaked. So we do get messed with. And
all the time.
All the time. And you have been messed with. Do you want to talk about that just a little bit? About the book sales?
Yeah, what folks need to understand, for your listeners out there, is that for folks like Kevin and myself and others who are just trying to call it like they see it and tell the truth, sometimes that truth is inconvenient, and there are people with secrets that want to hide them, and they have tremendous resources and can do a lot of different things to slow you down, impede you, but whatever they do, it's not something that they want to have pinned on them. They always want to have plausible deniability. And that's really a good measure. There's a cause and effect. You do something, they go at you, and then you backtrack it, and you could never get a straight answer. And in my case, back in May, I published an article on Yowza.com, YOWUSA.com, and I asked the question, is Comet Elenin a decoy? Is this, because even back in May, and actually from the get-go when this thing first came on the radar, so to speak, it has always been this odd duck. I've been doing this since 1999, and I have seen some pretty heavy disinfo campaigns, but nothing, I mean nothing, Kevin, holds a candle to what we had been seeing with Elenin. And what happened was, after I published that article, all of a sudden my books on Amazon all went from 1 to 3 day delivery to 2 to 3 weeks. Now, Amazon, in publishing sense, is the 800-pound gorilla. It's a huge chunk of any publisher's business. And the fastest way to throttle you is to say 2 to 3 weeks. Because now, you know, we have a consumer society. Where's my instant gratification? I want to know it's here, coming real quick. And so that really slows things down. And my distributors, Ingram, Lightning Source, fabulous people, and they were doing their level best to try and or find out from Amazon why this was happening, because my books have been on Amazon since the, I think, 2003, 2004, under my own imprint, and never have they been 2 to 3 weeks. It's always been 1 to 3 weeks. It's the way I do the publishing. And when they went to Amazon to get an answer as to why are you doing this, they couldn't get a straight answer from Amazon, other than they said vaguely, we're doing what's called velocity testing. Well, velocity testing, you know, in a marketing sense, is how many books you're selling in a period. And then, you know, they did this velocity testing on titles I've had out there for years. And so what they did was to velocity test it. They kill sales on the book by flagging it for 3 weeks delivery, and then they go from there. And I talked to an executive, and they were just stumped and stymied, and, you know, they're pulling their hair out. And finally, it was just admitted that only a small, out of the thousands and tens of thousands of titles that are carried, just a small handful of titles were affected, and yours truly was affected the most. And that is something where, you know, they can't make it look like you're obviously being singled out. But if they go and they hurt a few other people, then they have plausible deniability to go hurt you. And so that is the kind of stuff that goes on, and it goes on all the time. You know, for folks out there that think, you know, this is a big, wide, wonderful world and we can have open and fair discussions, no, it just doesn't work that way, folks. And so, you know, for me, dealing with that is, you just have to, you know, like they say in the movies, you know, it's the life we chose. It comes with the turf. Mm-hmm. So they do these kind of things. But also, I mean, look at what happened to Dutch since, you know, that YouTuber. Once he started reporting on Pisgah Crater, oh, man, they fell all over him like a ton of bricks. And there was, you know, there was cause for it, because what Pisgah Crater venting was saying is that there was volcanic activity northeast of Los Angeles and in an area with some pretty nasty fault zones. Not a good thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this goes on all the time, and it's just, you know, you deal with it, I deal with it. I remember that time on the show, and we actually could hear those cockroaches tapping away on their computers trying to figure out, you know, what to do next.
Yeah, and you could hear their voices. We captured that, and some of the folks that are listening tonight will remember that, because the next night, you had enhanced the sound and sent it to me, mm-hmm. and the next night I played that on the air. And once I did mm-hmm. that, they left me alone for a little while. But anyway, it's you know, folks need to understand that when you hit nerves, you get a reaction. I am of the opinion that a show like this that isn't hitting nerves probably needs to go off the air. You know, if we're not hitting some nerves, that means we're not getting to the truth. And when
That's
you get
right.
to the
if
truth, you're going to hit some
the
nerves.
Hits, who are we?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you nailed it, Kevin. You said what I would read. It'd be hard for me to say it, but let's be honest. If we weren't getting our butts kicked from time to time, who the hell are we?
Well, that's true. Of course, you know, my philosophy about that is, if you don't want your butt kicked, don't kick mine, because whatever you send my way is coming your way with momentum. And, you know, other folks, lots of folks think the thing to do is to duck and try to avoid being noticed. Don't be on the radar screen and all of that. You know, I don't try to be on the radar screen, but I don't worry about it. It's just, we do what we do. And when I get attacked, I publicize that. And then there are disinformation operatives out there who send me email and talk about, you know, I'm crazy. I'm talking about the government doing this and doing that, and they don't even know you exist. And, yeah, okay. All right. I've been at this for 11 years, and they started doing this kind of stuff in year one.
God, yeah.
Okay, so I kind of know a little bit about it. All right, I want to talk about Comet Yelenin. And let me say, we've done shows on this, and you and I have done shows on this, but we have some new listeners. Folks, out on the internet, there is this thing still going around out there that Yelenin is not a real person's name, and that it's some sort of code for extinction level event Nibiru is near, or Nibiru in November, or something like that. That's not true. It is a real person's name. His name is Leonid Yelenin. You can find a video on YouTube where he is being interviewed about the comet, and he's being interviewed by Russian TV news. They show him, and he shows his Russian ID card showing that he is who he says he is. And, you know, he's a genuine, real individual. All right. The truth about Comet Yelenin is, I would say, interesting enough, and for some people, frightening enough. You don't need to make stuff up. You don't need to try and make it faster, higher, louder, bigger, badder, and worse. All you have to do is know the actual facts. And the actual facts about Comet Yelenin are fascinating enough. When you were here last time, you talked about how it was already beginning to affect the Earth. And you talked about the when it comes into alignment with the Earth and the Sun, we generally then are having some pretty serious earthquake activity or bad weather. But since you were here with us last time, you have had some additional information come your way. And the way I put it on the website is more information is coming, and so is Yelenin.
That's a good way to put it. You know, what we've done since the last time I was on, and I've been working with a really fabulous research team, and it's Ed Douglas and Richard Goodwin and Larry Hyde and also Bill Zam and Susan, and we have just excellent people and also a lot of folks on the Planet X Town Hall message board who have been very helpful in gathering information, posting it, putting it where it's useful. We can work with it. And as a result of all this, we have put up on YouTube, and I did it. It went up on Wednesday. Since Wednesday, I think the video, and I just posted an improved version. I had an audio problem with the first one. And, but I mean, altogether, it's like 30,000 views somewhere in that vicinity.
Wow.
It just is smoking. And, the interest was, it surprised me how much, and especially, you know, we had come on the heels of David Morrison at NASA going, nothing to see here, move along, move along, move along, which, you know, when that came out, I'm sitting there going, okay, so fine, so they're going to go out and desensitize the public. And but for me, it's always, first and foremost, I like to talk to the folks that follow and support my work, because I can help them.
Mm-hmm.
So whether, you know, whether a video is going to be a blockbuster or not is not important. It's what I know that the people who follow my work are interested in, and I didn't realize that so many more people beyond that would be interested. What we're saying is that we looked at all the different aspects of Comet Elenin. You know, first off, there's been this sudden brightening, and the coma is the size of the planet Jupiter right now.
Okay, explain the coma for people that don't know what that is.
The coma is a big ball of dust and gas that surrounds the comet. And in terms of physical mass, I mean, it's huge on one hand. It's kind of like, you know, it's like a balloon you blow up at a kid's party. It's huge, but if you collapse the coma into an iron ingot, if you wanted, it would be the size of a large suitcase, for example. But still the same, what we were looking at was, one, the coma was brightening. That was for a comet that had been dubbed WIMPY. You know, it definitely got past the WIMPY factor. The other thing that was detected, it was outgassing hydrogen cyanide. Now, during 1910, what I point out in the video, by the way, for folks, it's on my YouTube channel, and that's youtube.com/yowbooks, Y-O-W-B-O-O-K-S, the comet, or the title of this, and it's 39 minutes, and there's a lot of information there. It's the Comet Elenin forecast for 9/2011 to 1/2012, and the Hopi Blue Star Kachina. And in there, we thought that, for us, the most significant development was the discovery of hydrogen cyanide. Now, that's the same stuff they use in gas chambers to kill convicts. But historically, what's interesting was, back in 1910, and I explained this in the video, they detected hydrogen cyanide in Halley's Comet. And it really put a panic through a lot of people here in the U.S. They were, you know, some of them were doing the la-la side with comet parties, and others were buying gas masks and, you know, going to snake oil salesmen and getting comet pills and whatnot, because they were really terrified we'd fly through the tail of the comet and that we would then, you know, be gassed. Now, in our case, we passed through the tail of the comet, but we passed through the residual aspect of it. The comet is overtaking us. And so that tail, which is always pointing away from the sun, is ahead of us, but we're arcing into it. So what we're doing is we're merging in on the residual of the tail.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll come back with flying through the tail of Comet Elenin right after this.
To the Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Marshall Masters. We're talking about Comet Elenin, and Marshall, as we went to break, you were telling us about the fact that we will be flying, we'll be arcing into the tail of the comet.
We're arcing into the tail. We're not concerned particularly that, as folks were in 1910 with hydrogen cyanide poisoning, you know, on the planet. That was a real panic thing back in then. But the reason why we are fascinated with the hydrogen cyanide is for two other specific reasons. One is it will enhance the blueness of the comet. And two is that it is a natural dielectric. All right. And if you think of it like, well, the battery case, you know, the battery in your car. And that battery case holds all that energy and acid and whatnot in there. And it doesn't interact with anything, just keeps it contained. So when you hit it, hit the ignition, your car starts. Well, at least it should in theory. Now, with a natural dielectric, what it means is we have a comet that's taken approximately 10,000 years to arrive at the core of the system, depending on estimates. That's a long time, which it could, in an electric universe model, harvest a lot of energy, build up a large negative charge. And the hydrogen cyanide is a natural dielectric, in other words, keeps it in there. And one of the things that even David Morrison, who is the official poo-poo guy for NASA, said, they hadn't had a chance to really take a hard look at the core of the comet yet. And this, while at the same time he's going, don't worry, nothing to see here, move along. And for us, it's interesting because this comet could very well, all right, and I think that the flyby of this comet could prove to be a really interesting test of the electric universe theory, which essentially says comets are a lot more than just dirty snowballs, which is how science views them. And the point that we're concerned about is the we see a range of, in our scenario, which we present in the video, we present there's essentially three possible likely outcomes. One is it's a non-eventful flyby, an interesting one. I certainly am lighting the candles for number one. Yippee. Number two is that it's another Halley's Comet flyby event where there's a lot of worry and concern, in some cases fear, and that it could be attended by some natural calamities, which would be difficult to associate, but other than through timing. And there is a case for that. Mincer Amerbach had a paper. He makes a prima facie case for the alignments, enough that even if half the data is right and more than half the data was accurate in terms of timing with certain celestial alignments and earthquake and volcanism here on the planet. And and it's a well-known thing, you know, with in terms of the moon, when the moon is closer to us, you know, we're going to expect more kinds of activity. When planets line up, if there's a coronal mass ejection from the sun and has a southern orientation, it's going to be a heck of a lot nastier for us than if it has a northern orientation. And so there's a lot of basis for this electrical connection between bodies, but still the electrical universe theory tends to get hammered on.
Okay, now let's take a moment and talk about that electrical universe theory. What are we talking mm-hmm. about here?
Well, what it says is that there's, you know, the objects in our system, it's just not gravity, all right? That there's more at play. There are other forces. And so in an electric universe theory, just saying, well, yeah, Comet Ellen is, let's say it has a nucleus of 3.5-4 kilometers in diameter. So you're saying, how on earth could that affect a planet? But in an electric universe, it's a conduit. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you think about, you got a big, beautiful chandelier in your house, you know, with a gazillion lights on it, but you got that one little switch on the wall, and if you don't flip that and complete the circuit, you're not going to light up this huge chandelier. And so you have these kinds of other relationships that are going on.
So what you're saying then is that Comet Ellenin could act something like, in an electric universe, could act something like a switch that when certain things line up just right, there could be a flow or a discharge of electricity.
Exactly. And matter of fact, that's the analogy I use. Could these alignments and these circumstances push the button, so to speak? And if that is the case, then trust me, we will all be looking up at the sky, pointing upwards, and collectively poo-pooing our pants, okay? Because, you know, we did a comparison for folks of Comet Elenin to other comets from the past that have done things people didn't expect or caused a lot of fear. First was Halley's Comet in 1910. It outgassed. That was when they discovered, and it was really somewhat of a recent capability in science at the time. It had only been in the late 18th century that they had discovered the spectral analysis, so that they could see what the composition of a comet was. And so when it was announced that Halley's Comet had hydrogen cyanide and everyone was concerned that we would fly through the tail of that, it just caused a real, real lot of concern and worry. Now, the other comet we found interesting was Comet S4 Linear. And the reason why it was S4 Linear completely came apart, I mean, it just boom, like it hit a brick wall, just as it was about to cross the ecliptic. The ecliptic is the plane of the system. And that's important because we have southern skies, you have northern skies. The ecliptic is, that's the plane of the system. Essentially, you could think of it as like, you know, the equator of the sun stretched all the way out to the 12 signs of the zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a polarity shift. You know, you're going, you know, a battery's got a positive terminal and negative terminal. All right, an electric universe, you're looking at the same things. And so if you have something that is passing through the ecliptic, all right, then there's an electrical change of state, and it gets affected. Now, Linear completely came apart. At the time when Linear came apart, first thing, we followed that story on Yowza.com. We published on it. That was the first time I was really starting to see a lot of stuff being injected to create confusion. There was one astronomer in off the coast of Spain who was doing a really good job of tracking this thing, and just as he was about to make a really significant observation, fires happened. Court plausible deniability again, but a whole bunch of fires on the hill below him started up, and the smoke made it impossible for the astronomer to do the viewing. And NASA took its sweet time in grooming a couple of photos that it finally, eventually, weeks later, released. And we were really curious as to why this thing had suddenly come apart. The theories at the time was that it was an old comet and it was time. This is how old comets die. There was one astronomer who said, no, it hit something. And this poor guy just was beat up and chopped to pieces like a rag doll. But we were following that. And what stuck in our minds about it was that you have a comet that is more likely when it passes the ecliptic to do something odd than not. Now, that is also consistent with what they've observed in deep space. All right, we're at a point where, you know, in 2012, we're coming up through the center of the galactic plane. And this is an area of space where large young suns tend to supernova more than not. So, you know, you have these shifts and changes. Then the third one that we point out in the video is Comet Holmes, which was, I believe, 2007. And Comet Holmes, suddenly and unexpectedly, it was another one of those wimpy comets that nobody, you know, so what? You know, you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, go watch it if that's your bag. But the thing brightened, and it brightened dramatically. Its coma expanded to a size greater than that of our own sun. So for a brief period of time, this comet was the largest object in our solar system. All right?
Well, when you say it was the largest object in the solar system, you mean visibly.
Largest visible in terms of a visible diameter and a shape and a size, not in terms of mass.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
You know, coma is just a big dust and gas cloud. But in terms of looking up and there's a physical, a spherical shape, it was the largest spherical shape in the sky, period. You know, just by sheer diameter in terms of the size of it. Not in the density of it, but in the size.
All right.
So when we look at Comet Ellen, and what we see is we have this comet that's been coming in. It's outgassing hydrogen cyanide. It's taken a long time to get here. So in an electric universe model, that means it's building up a hell of a charge. And on September 11th, 9/11, it reaches its point of perihelion, which is its closest distance to the sun. And then from there, when we get out to the 26th, the 26th is a real dicey date. That's the in our estimate. And our worst-case scenario, we present several days. And at different risk levels, that is the maximum risk date, September 26th, because this is when it not only comes closest to the Earth, but it is crossing the ecliptic at the same time. So in the period from the 11th to the 26th, if something big and nasty is going to happen, that would be more likely the time. That is not to say we would not see other concerns. We do see other concerns. It depends in terms of where we are in relationship to the comet at one given time or another, but we do not see the threat diminishing and then going away until the middle of January in 2012.
Okay.
So, you know, we paint this all out.
Well, we've got a break coming up here in less than a minute,
sure.
So I don't want us to get into something too deep here. But an observation. Earlier you mentioned that, I think you said his name is David Morrison. You mentioned him as the official poo-poo guy of NASA. I've been checking the organizational chart at NASA, and I have to tell you, I can't find a slot there that says official poo-poo guy.
Well, that's just one of our... Hey, that's just what I call him, the official poo-poo guy. Because, I mean, it's always that... He's got that... Listen to us, because you're not smart enough to think for yourself.
Yeah, not smarter than a fifth grader. Okay, we're going to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Marshall Masters, and we're talking about the oncoming, soon-to-arrive Comet Ellenine. Let me ask you a question, Marshall, about the...
Yeah.
You mentioned the Hopi Blue Kachina prophecy. All right. Now, we can get into what that is, but first I want to ask you, why that prophecy? Why have you focused on that one? When there are literally hundreds of end times type prophecies available to choose from, including Nostradamus. So why did you focus on the Hopi prophecy?
Well, because it describes physically what we're seeing better than the other prophecies.
Okay, fair enough.
Simply put, you know, the Blue Star Kachina prophecy, and there's... when you're looking at prophecy and it's coming from folklore, you're not going to, if you take an absolute view of it, a fundamentalist view of it, if you will, then, you know, you're saying, well, this exactly has to happen, if that is going to happen, if that's going to happen. Whereas we tend to look at it more as all prophecies being relative and experiential. It is people that are seeing in the view into the future. And so it's going to be subject to what they're seeing and how they explain things. But you can look through a prophecy and you can find some pretty good anchors. All right. Now, a good classic prophecy is going to be in two parts. It's going to have a harbinger, and then it's going to have an event. A harbinger is a sign given in the prophecy that says, if this prophecy is coming to pass, here's what you will see happening in advance, and here is your point of no turn back.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then there's the event. And if you have ignored the harbinger, then the event is what happens to you, and it's a very unpleasant thing, usually. So the point of prophecy is really, it's looking at potentials in the future and understanding that we can affect outcomes. So if we're going down a timeline, we're going down a timeline. Now, what the Hopi did in this was that they had a few things that really did catch our eye in terms of what they were saying, that there's multiple bodies involved, that first comes the Blue Star Kachina, and it will have nephews with it. So it is going to be approaching with other objects. What those objects are, we don't know, but it's not coming alone. Something else seems to be following along with it. And in the video, we do show, it's a little GIF animation we repeat, but it does, you can see Ellen and you can also see it has what the Hopi called nephews, and they're moving in a parallel course. They're not in orbit around it. They're just moving in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that.
The next thing is the Blue Star Kachina is because it is when it unmasks, which will be sudden. Okay? So what that really says to us is if it is a sudden unmasking, the Kachina will unmask itself. It will reveal itself. And it is blue, all right? If you look back at Comet Holmes 2007, it was a big blue ball. With Comet Ellen, it would be a big blue ball as well. And that's particularly because of the hydrogen cyanide, which is going to give it that increased blueness. So we have the nephews. We have the potential that this object could outburst. And it would be a very large bluish event. And the other thing is that in the prophecy it says that following behind that, in a relatively short period of time, which could say, you know, anywhere from 6 months to a year, is the red Kachina, which is the much larger, much more destructive of the two. They're both, the Kachinas are spoken of as gods.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what Kachina means.
Well, a Kachina is you have a Kachina and you have a totem, and it is a representation of their gods.
Okay.
It's no different than walking into a Catholic church and seeing a statuary of, you know, Jesus and Mary. So it's just a physical representation of the deities. And in this case, which there's multiple deities in the prophecy, and one follows on the heels of the other. Now,
so do you take the red Kachina?
We are saying absolutely that it is the Blue Star Kachina, but the Blue Star Kachina does really lend a very good description to what we're seeing in the hard data, with the possibility that there could be this harbinger fulfillment, that this could happen, at which point, that's when we know we have the harbinger signs. That is when we know, the Hopi know, that what the Hopi say is when that happens, the dances stop.
Okay, well, now let me ask you a question here about, let me ask you a question, pardon? About the Blue Star Kachina, sure. And the red Kachina.
Okay,
so we have the Blue Star Kachina. If Elenine is the Blue Star Kachina, then and if that prophecy is accurate, then fairly close in a fairly close period of time, the red coccina appears, and it's far more destructive. Do you take that to mean what people are referring to as Nibiru?
Absolutely.
That's really interesting. That's very interesting because of the Torah code you sent me.
Yeah, and you know, this, I didn't get this until after we published our findings. We published our findings. Let me just give your listener a little background. I've been working with a producer, Richard Shaw Pinlight, in pinlight.com in La Hollywood. He's an award-winning cinematographer, does documentaries. He's working on a couple of different things. One is Watchers projects, and I've been in the last Watchers. But he's also working on Torah Code, which I've been working with him on Torah Code. Torah Code, for those of you who are familiar with Bible Code by Drazen, the Bible Code is really a small subset of Torah Code. Torah Code research goes back about 1,000 years. And there's been this long-standing interest to find meanings other than the written literal meanings in the Torah, which is the first five books of the Old Testament.
In Hebrew.
And in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Torah Code researchers, what Torah Code really does is it's much more precise measurement than what Bible Code Drazen was doing when his first book came out. He had an old PC, and he's basically working by himself. Here, with Torah Code Research, there's a whole team of people. You have linguists that are phrasing the search strings. You have computer scientists that are executing them along with the help of a team of rabbis in Israel. You have code breakers. These are the guys that were, you know, breaking secret codes for the CIA and the NSA, and they're working on that here as well, and they're doing what's called the casino testing. And so what happens is when you get a Torah code matrix and it's presented, there's a path that it goes through. You have a professional linguist that phrases the question, and from the professional linguist you have computer scientists that are doing the model testing or finding actually the code tables, excuse me. Then you have folks that are code breakers that are actually doing a monkey test to see if this is statistically relevant or not. Does it get to a threshold where you could say, look, there is no way you could find this table in Moby Dick or Gone with the Wind or something else? And this debunkers love to do that. They'll find a couple of hits of Moby Dick, and it makes their case for them.
Okay, we have to step away for a break. When we come back, though, Marshall, I'm going to put that Torah Code page up on our TV channel in the members area, and we'll talk about that because it's got some pretty interesting stuff on it. All right, folks, we'll return right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. I'm delighted you're here, and I think you will be too. We're talking with Marshall Masters. Marshall is discussing with us some pretty curious stuff about Comet Elenine, and as we went away for break, two things happened. As we went away for break, I mentioned that I want to get into this Torah code just a little bit, and we're going to do that. Another thing happened is I checked my flash messages, and Marshall, I have a flash message from Dave in Australia, and Dave wants to know, he said, you know, that I'm on record, me, Kevin Smith, I'm on record as having said that I don't think that Nibiru is going to be all that big a deal, which is not exactly accurate, Dave. I'll clear that up in just a minute. But he wants to know, if I don't think it's a big deal, then why would I have Marshall Masters on talking about it? That's a fair question, don't you think, Marshall?
It is.
Okay,
you're
here's
curious.
The deal. I have said I don't think December 21st is the big deal. I don't think December 21st, 2012, is the end of the world. I don't think there's any significance to that specific date. I have said, if you'll recall, I do think that we are going to see an increase in both the number and intensity of calamities and catastrophes up through and just beyond that date. But there are people who are singling out that date and saying, that's it, that's the end of time. Not by a long shot, folks. It's not. But there is one other thing I want to say, and that is some people are looking for smoking gun evidence, and we talked about this today, Marshall. Folks, if you wait till the gun is smoking, you waited too long, you've been shot. So,
yeah, well, if you're waiting for smoking gun, go to New York. Surf's up, baby.
Well, but the thing is that, you know, what we have to do is we have to look at evidence, and there's none of this is proof of anything, but there is evidence of something. So you look at the evidence, and if the evidence says, you know what, looks like it's going to rain really hard tomorrow, well, you know, you need to get your umbrella ready just in case it does rain. It might not, but if it does, you're ready. And so, you know, that's what this is all about. And if all of this happens, you heard Marshall say, we're not saying that this is the Blue Kachina, but it seems to be matching the descriptions of the Blue Kachina at this point. So if you wait for the smoking gun, it's too late. The gun's gone off. You've been shot. So what you need to do is hear what he's got to say. And if it sounds like rain tomorrow, grab an umbrella and be ready. If it doesn't rain, put the umbrella away. No big deal.
That's right. And if you want proof, go to a liquor store.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, so let's talk about the Torah code. Now, the Torah, for those of you just joining us, if you don't know what the Torah is, that is the Hebrew name for the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, of the Bible, written in Hebrew. Okay? I mean, you do understand that the Bible was not written in English, right? I hope so. It was written, the Old Testament, written in Hebrew. The New Testament, written in Koine Greek. And then there are splatterings and smatterings of little phrases from other languages all through the Old and New. So when we talk about the Torah code, Marshall described for us, it's something similar to the Bible code, but far more accurate. And it deals only with the first five books in Hebrew, written in Hebrew. Okay, now, you had written an article. You had published this article. After that, I believe I'm getting the chronology straight here, but if I'm not, you correct me. And after that, this Torah code came up. Tell us how that came up.
Well, this actually came up as a result of doing the publishing the findings, and I was actually talking with Shaw at Pinlight late last week about this. And I said that, you know, we were really fascinated with this outgassing of hydrogen cyanide. And that really caught their attention. That, you know, partly because, I mean, that takes you back to, you know, the concentration camps, Treblinka and Auschwitz and what happened there. But, you know, it got them working, and they prepared a table. The linguists got together, and I got this from Richard, the day after, I got it on Thursday. Wednesday was when I put up the original version of my video, which I've now updated. It had an audio track problem. Say, you know, you're slugging through to get something out. And I had my studio speaker set up for radio and not TV, and so I missed that right channel problem. But on Thursday, I get this table from him. Now, you've got it there on the video, so let's go through here and talk a little bit on this table for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And the first line that you see it says in 5771.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, first off, I will say the table is still going through the casino vetting, but it is an incredibly tight table, which is surprising. There was some other stuff here that was surprising for me as well. But it says in 5771. Now, 5771 on the Jewish calendar, the Hebrew calendar, the year 5771, when you equate it to the Gregorian calendar, is from the period September 9, 2010 to September 28, 2011. Okay? Now, the thing of it is 5771, September 28, earlier in the show, I told you, the window of highest likelihood of a nasty thing to happen is going to be between 9/11 and what? 9/26. So, our date range where we see the greatest likelihood of an LNN event, some sort of interaction, outbursting, something that really throws us for a loop, is going to happen in the last waning days of the Jewish year 5771. So that's already designated. Then, here was something I found very interesting because it is showing Nibiru, N-I-B-I-R-U. And the reason why I found very surprising is that before, when they've looked for Nibiru, it was difficult to find in 2012. It pops up in 2013, but with the Aramaic spelling of Nabiru, N-A-B-I-R-U, which would be the more logical spelling. Nibiru is the spelling that was coined by Zachariah Sitchin, all right, which is Nibiru is just easier to roll off the tongue for Western speakers than Nabiru. Now, you see a conjunction of Elenin, the star, and then under that you see 20th of Elul. And that translates on the Gregorian calendar to September 19th to the 20th. So what you see is Elenin becomes as bright as a star on or about September 19th through the 20th, in the Hebrew year of 5771, which comes to a close in September 28th. And it is showing Nibiru, all right? And the thing about it is that Nibiru, if you look at it, the letters for Nibiru, which looks like, it starts with the first Hebrew letter, which looks like an X, all right, yellow X on red, is connected to Nibiru. So what this is saying is that there is a connection between these two objects. It's not saying that it is one or the other. It is saying that there is a connection and that Elenin is going to look like a second star briefly during the period of the 20th of Elul, which will be September 19th to 20th.
Also, let me interject this. With Hebrew and with talking about, you know, dates, in the West, and I guess all over the world, we talk about sun up till sun up. And, you know, we generally say, well, on this date, and we think in terms of daytime. But the Hebrew way of reckoning when a day starts, it starts at sundown on the previous day. And you see that in Genesis where it says the evening and the morning were the first day.
Right,
so
the lunar calendar.
Yeah, so what we're looking at, I would suspect, is we're looking at the evening of September 19th until the evening of September 20th.
Yep, that's what we're looking at.
Now, what's interesting about this, if we start down there with the date, and we move upward through the Torah code, the next thing, we start with a date, the next thing up we see is the star Elanin. And behind it, Nibiru.
Mm-hmm.
And that matches what you said about the Hopi prophecy with the blue kachina, and then following after it, the red kachina.
Precisely. Precisely. And this was something that was, I mean, this Torah code table just came, I mean, we had finished our findings, we had written the script, we had published, you know, weeks in it, well, not weeks, I mean, we were really working on it pretty close up to the point, because we were pulling in new data as it was coming in. And at some point, you just have to say, all right, you know, we take a snapshot here and we go with what we've got.
Mm-hmm.
But during this time, other than discussing it with Richard Shaw and just, you know, because we're talking about different projects and we're working on Watchers, and he's interested in, for his next Watchers 3, he wants to do come up and do something with me on Elanin. And so he's been following that with me, and I've been following Torah code. And this was just something. He was talking to the guys in Israel, in Jerusalem, and he was telling them about what we're doing on the Elanin research and the Hopi prophecy. And like I said, once he mentioned that it had hydrogen cyanide, it just, you know, it was an emotional hot button thing, and it really got them going. They generated this table, and then they were just stunned at what they found.
Well, you know, I'm pretty stunned looking at it, but here's why. It doesn't surprise me that that shows up in the Torah code, but it, what surprises me is the order that it shows up, the order that those words show up in the Torah code match the Hopi prophecy order. In other words, the chronology of the Hopi
yes.
prophecy matches the order in which these things show up in the Torah code.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm looking at this thing when I first saw it, and my first thing out of my mouth was, holy Torah code, Batman! I mean, who? You know? Oh, no! You know, and I'm sitting there, and I mean, it's like, you know, I'll tell you something. I've for years, my greatest hope always has been, always will be, is that I live long enough to hear the world laughing at my expense. Because I really don't want to be right about any of this. I really don't. I don't want any of that satisfaction. Thank you. Leave home without it. But when I saw this Torah code table, it just dropped me on my head.
Tell you what I want to do. I want to invite our audience to participate with us, to join the conversation. And we do that by opening the telephone lines, so let me do that. And the telephone lines are open. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. If you're in Canada or if you're in the United States of America, please use that telephone number, 623-444-5889. If you're anywhere else in the world, you can call that number. It'll work. But we know international long distance is expensive, and so for you, if you're not in Canada, not in the USA, for you, we have a flash message option on my website. So you can go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down till you see the picture about tonight's show, and right above that picture, you will see the link that says flash message. Let's go to the telephone now, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Rex from Miami.
Hello, Rex.
Hi, Rex.
Hey. Yeah, I had a couple questions. The very first time I heard about the Bible code, a couple things that I was curious about was, I understand that Hebrew has no vowels, which I think would be a pretty big deal about matching words without vowels, and that the second thing is the number of digits. I just wonder how many numbers actually appear in the Bible to where you could get a whole year in sequence.
Well, I couldn't speak to the second part. The first part on the vowels is that there's two forms of Hebrew, Sephardic and Ashkenazi. The Sephardic is what the Torah was written in, and so it's like English. You got to have to know how to pronounce it. Let's be honest. If I took somebody from never been here, basically could just speak a few words of English, and I wrote chrysanthemum and handed it to them, that's pretty tough, especially if you don't know a vowel from a consonant. There's also another form of Hebrew called Ashkenazi. And that's used quite a bit more by the Reformed and the lighter variants. The older form of Hebrew is used by the more traditional Jews, the Orthodox Jews, whereas the conservatives and the Reformed tend to use Ashkenazi because the vowels are noted and it's easier to find. But in this case, it's still an English easy language. It is Hebrew is one of the easiest languages to learn. It is incredibly logical and well ordered and well laid out. And if you go to Israel, you see people immigrating there from all over the world, and they learn the language and they learn it very quickly, and they become proficient very quickly.
Yeah, let me throw something into
the
this.
The lack of vowel markings is not a problem.
Let me throw something into this, Rex. You've heard me talk about that I speak Serbian. Let me ask you how to spell the word Serb. How would you spell it?
S-E-R-B.
In English, that's correct. But in Serbian, it's S-R-B. Well, it's actually C, our letter C. And then our letter P, and then our letter B. That's what it looks like to us, CPB. But that's not. That makes the sound Serb. So anyone who reads Serbian and speaks Serbian knows when they see those letters, it makes the sound Serb. But then if they translate it into English, for you, they have to put an E in there. And they have to spell it with an S E and an R B.
If you had like a K V N, would it always, in Hebrew? I mean, just hypothetically, would there only be one possibility? Then it would always be Kevin. It wouldn't be three
right.
or four variations.
Right.
Sound.
Yeah. The letters have a sound. See, in English, letters don't necessarily have a sound. The letter A. What is the sound of the letter A? Well, it can be A or it can be A. What's the sound of the letter C? Can be S or K. But it's not that way in Hebrew, and it's not that way in most languages. In most languages, the letter has a sound, period. So when you see that letter, like in English, we've got all these rules, I before E, except after C, and so forth. You don't have that. If it's there, you say the sound of the letter. It doesn't have a name. It has a sound. So we say S-E-R-B. But if a Serbian, in Serbian, in the language, was spelling it, they would say S-E-R-B.
Okay. Well, if there's only one way you could come up with a word then from a series of consonants, then I guess it's okay. I was just afraid, thinking like English, where if you're missing vowels, there's a lot of possibilities for the words.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's not true in Hebrew, then I guess it's not an issue.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the problems with English is we have, in my opinion, way too many vowels, so that we're not always sure what sound a word makes. We have to learn what that, you know, when we're little kids growing up, you have to learn, in this case, it has this sound. Like C-O-M-B, yeah. Comb. T-O-M-B,
yeah.
Tomb. Why isn't it comb and tomb? Well, it just isn't. But you don't have that in these other languages because the written letter has a sound, and that's it. You make that
correct.
Sound.
That's it. That's it. It wonder about transliterated.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rich.
Pardon?
Oh, I wonder about transliterated foreign words then. If there's multiple variations that could be translated into the same Hebrew letters.
I don't understand the question.
They do the same thing we do, all right, is that, you know, you're going to put together the sounds based on your language. It's transliterated. But the thing here that's most relevant, all right, I mean, you're getting into the semantics of, a form of communication that dates back thousands of years, and it is very consistent. It's very easy for those who understand the language can follow it consistently. It's not like English where we have words, and particularly, I'll tell you, you know, I taught English as a second language. Synonyms and antonyms, they drive people absolutely crazy. What's the difference between a steak and a steak?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? One you drive in the ground, what you eat, okay? Or you have a stake in the game. Or, you know, here's my stake. I'm going to ante up my stake for the... And we have different... English is that way. It can be very, very difficult. Hebrew, no, it's not. It's very direct. It's why it's easy to remember. But here's the key thing for your caller, is that Hebrew that you see in the Torah... And what I would suggest to you is that go visit a local synagogue, you know, and walk in and ask somebody. They'll be glad to give you the information. They'll show you, explain to you. They'll answer those questions, and in a way that'll be meaningful to you right there and then. But for the folks listening on the radio today, what you really need to grasp is that if you go into a synagogue and you open up a Torah scroll, you are going to see those words formed exactly the way they were formed when it was written, okay, in the days following the Exodus. Because the Torah is faithfully, character by character, it is always done exactly the same way. And they do them by hand, and if they make a mistake, they don't white out, they toss it, all right? And so there's been this faithful reproduction. Now, if you get into the Christian Bible, well, choose your eschatology, choose your publisher, choose your edition, okay? And, for example, the term destroyer is used by the Hebrews for Planet X, Nibiru. And it is the same word that was used by the ancient Egyptians. They, too, called it the destroyer. That was the name of it to them. If you look in the Torah, it is destroyer. But if you look in a Christian Bible, it will vary as to who did the translation, because it's gone through multiple iterations.
All right, we have to step away for break. Rex, thanks much for the call. Interesting question. I think an important question. All right. We'll be back, folks, right after this.
America, and you're listening to The Kevin Smith Show, like no other talk radio on earth.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. The telephone lines are open, ladies and gentlemen. Got a question about Comet Elenine, about Nibiru. This is one of the leading voices on the planet who is talking with us tonight. One of the leading voices on the planet on those subjects, Elenine and Nibiru. 623-444-5889 is the number to call. The telephone lines are open, and Marshall, we have a flash message from Paola in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to read it in just a second. I want to preface it with a statement. neither Marshall nor Kevin have said that the Torah code is something that you should write in stone and say, you shouldn't chisel it in stone and say, well, if it's in the Torah code, that's it, that's done. We're not saying that because, you know, it is interesting. It's an indicator, but it's only one indicator among many. And so, you know, it's not, nobody here is trying to get you to believe in the Torah code, okay? We just offer it to you as an additional piece of information that's quite interesting. However, this is what Paola says. Why does the Nibiru come in this one and it is Nibiru others? And I think what she's saying is, why in this case in the Torah code does it show up as Nibiru, and you said in all other places you've seen it show up as Nibiru?
Excellent question. I think, first off, it depends on what the linguists are doing when they're phrasing the questions. So I would look at that first. I was really surprised when they were doing this table. They actually started with a few things, as Richard told me about it. And when they started adding the elements, that was when Nibiru showed up. And what we did with their linguist, and this was, almost 2 years ago, and we prepared a list of keyword search terms for them, mm-hmm. and they basically have been using this list of keywords. We were just out there harvesting every possible known name for Planet X, and some estimates say there's as many as 50 different names. It's just, you know, I get amazed. They keep coming and coming. You got Planet X, Destroyer, Frightener, Wormwood, Herkobolus, the Red Star, the Red Kachina, the Dragon, the Frightener. I mean, you could just go on and on when you start digging into folklore from all four corners of the globe. Mm-hmm. You start finding this thing, and it's other, and it's under different names. And that is something you just should expect to see.
You know, you and I have talked about this. In fact, I guess if we added all the hours we've talked about it over the past 2 or 3 years, we'd come up with a week's worth of telephone conversation, nonstop, 24 hours a day. And we've talked about it a lot. But the, you know, the thing that I look at this and I can say, okay, there's no question Elohim is coming. No question about that. That's an established mm-hmm. fact. It is, there's no question there are things moving with it. The astronomers have photographed that. There are things
Correct.
Moving with it. No question about it. But if it turns out to be the blue Kachina and following it is the red Kachina, you know, my attitude towards that is, you know what, I can't stop it. So I'm not worried about it. I'm going to live till I don't. Now, I have made preparations to survive through catastrophe. And maybe that'll work.
Mm-hmm.
It might. And then again, it might not. I mean, I may go up in a puff, you know. But my attitude towards it is, okay, so I can't stop it. So what? You know, but I am here today and I have to live today. And, I'm not going to let the anxiety over what might happen ruin my day today. I'll give you an opportunity to respond to that in just a moment, but I want to go to the telephone
okay.
first and, let's take this call. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Good evening, Kevin. It's Deb from Columbus.
Hello, Deb.
Hi. Deb. I wanted to ask Marshall. Hi, Marshall. I want to ask you a question. You mentioned the Hopi blue and red Kachina. Are you familiar with any of the other Native prophecies mentioning Nibiru, and then also Comet Elenine? And I'll take the answer off off the air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dan.
Well, you know, there could be other prophecies that talk about Elenine. What we saw is Elenine is definitely mentioned in the Hopi prophecy. Now, one thing that's interesting to note, and I think Deb's question was really stellar. I like that.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Good question. What we have to remember first off is Elenine has taken about 10,000 years to come to the core of the system, you know. And so when we're looking at a lot of the folklore events, particularly the ones of the Colburn Bible, which were written by the ancient Egyptians following the 10 plagues of Exodus, while the Hebrews were out there in the Sinai. And at that time, they were not talking about Elenine, but Elenine would not have been there at that time. But the Hopi people, they have very, very deep roots, and they go back thousands of years, and there's folklore from people that they inherited that became part of their culture. But also, they do talk about how the ant people helped rescue them the last time. And they're waiting for the Space Brothers, if you will, to come back. So the Elenine, the Blue Kachina, Red Kachina, could, if you know you want to extrapolate this, it could be the result of them being told this by these extraterrestrial brothers that helped rescue them during the a previous flyby that was then incorporated into their folklore, carried forward by subsequent generations to these days. So it's how it gets here is a convoluted process sometimes, but the Blue Star, and I have to admit, I mean, when I first started doing this stuff, I was really of no mind to pay any credibility at all to any prophecy. To me, it was all who shot John. But, you know, you do get to a point where you run out of science. You're not getting the answers from the science heads. And so we started looking at other things, and no differently. I mean, you look at Nobel laureates, and they've done a lot of paranormal research on channeling and other things. And, you know, these are folks, even Madame Curie dabbled in it for a time. So when you run out of answers in the conventional, traditional, authorized paradigm of science as we know it today, when that runs out of answers and you don't run out of curiosity, you start looking elsewhere. And that's where you wind up in prophecy. And I remember looking, I mean, years ago, started looking at the Blue Star Kachina prophecy, and I have a particular affinity with the Hopi. You know, I grew up in Arizona. I know these people. I know their nature. And I think they're a fabulous people. They're of the earth. They've really gotten a raw deal, you know, from the white eyes. And they stayed peaceful. They didn't strap on bomb belts and run into cafes and kill women and children. Okay? They lumped it. They took it. Because their prophecy tells them you're going to wait for the Blue Star Kachina and the Red Star Kachina. And to their credit, the Hopi have gone, they have gone and talked to the world leaders. They've gone to the UN. They have tried to explain the prophecies are being fulfilled. The end of your life as you know it is coming upon you. And this is when you need to return to the old ways of being in harmony with the earth. Okay? And they're making the warnings, and it reminds me of, you know, the old, did you ever see the old Benny Hill show out of England?
Oh, yeah.
Benny Hill used to like to, you know, hit people on the head, you know, it kind of is an insulting thing. Now go away, slap them on the head, top of the head. And it, same thing happened to the Hopi. So here they're coming to warn the very people that really gave them a heck of a shaft, and they're being ignored.
Well, you know, people
so
that won't pay attention.
There's integrity in their message, and I find that very compelling.
People
and
that won't pay attention to the warnings are just going to get what they get, you know? And that's just the way it goes. We have a flash message here from Marty in the UK. He says, Kevin, I like your approach to this, but I'm still a bit anxious about all this. Cheers. Yeah, well, let me ask you a question, Marty. Think of it this way. If the sun suddenly, for whatever reason, goes out, in 8 minutes, the Earth will know it. It takes 8 minutes for the light to get here, so the light goes out in 8 minutes. For that 8 minutes, you had no idea the light went out. For that 8 minutes, you lived. And if you knew that the light was going to go out in 8 minutes, if you knew 8 minutes from now it's all going to be dark, what could you do about it? Nothing. In about 30 minutes after the lights go out, the Earth is in a deep freeze. Within a couple of hours, almost everything on the planet is dead. But for that 8 minutes, when the light went out, you didn't know it. You just lived 8 minutes. Well, since there's nothing you can do about whatever it is that's going to happen, why not just live your 8 minutes? You know, and it may be 8 years. It may be 80 years. You don't know. There's nothing that you or I or anybody else can do about whatever is coming. What you can do, the only thing you can do, is to affect how you live between now and then. And, you know, make every minute count. Don't waste any of them. Make them all count. Do something that if you knew for sure 1 hour from now you were going to die, what would you be doing? Well, why aren't you doing it?
Yeah. Why are you deferring it? But here's another way to look at it. Next time you sit down to write a check for fire insurance for your house, or for collision insurance for your car, or for health insurance for your health, tell me something. How much time do you spend wringing your hands and agonizing over that your house could burn down, that you could drop dead of a heart attack, all right, or you could smash into somebody and, you know, meet a terrible end in a car crash? You don't agonize over that.
Hate to do it. We have to step away from break. All right, folks. We'll pick up right after this. We have a flash message from Puerto Rico, and we'll take that up when we come back from this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on final approach. That means we only have a few minutes left in tonight's show. And, Marshall, I want to get to this flash message from Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Leonardo in Puerto Rico. And he says, "Hi, Kevin and guest. Good show tonight and good music. I, too, like rock and roll. Kevin, I consider your reasoning to be true. It won't be the end of the world, but it will be the end of us. I can't afford a $1 billion ticket for the Ark, so bring it on. I'm prepared, and so are you, my friend." Well, I appreciate that, Leonardo, but I'll tell you what, I don't think it's going to be the end of us. It's going to be the end of some of us. First of all, most of the people who are in denial, most of the people who have their head in the sand and their butt in the air, on this issue, on any kind of possible catastrophe coming along, very likely most of them will be in the first load that go, because they're going to be hanging out in the breeze exposed. And, you know, and even if they don't go in the first wave, they're not prepared. They don't have any food or water stockpiled. They think that's foolish. I keep food and water stockpiled. It doesn't matter whether someone's predicting the end or not, because you never know what can happen. I mean, look, just tornadoes. A tornado comes through and knocks out all the electricity, and there's horrendous damage like there was in Joplin, Missouri. It's a while before you have conveniences that run on electricity. It's a while. And you know, you've got to have food you can prepare without electricity. You got to have water to drink and so forth. I stay prepared. But I don't think, I think people that that know what could be coming down the pike and prepare as best you can. There's no 100% guarantee of anything, but you prepare as best you can. You got a shot at it, you know. You got a shot at making it, and I'm prepared to continue living to be old enough to be a burden on everyone. That's my goal. I want to be old enough to be a burden on everyone.
You want to be a codgety pain in the tuchus.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm already that. I want to be an actual burden to everybody. I know people say, I don't want to be a burden to anybody. I do. You know, I want to get old enough that people have to take care of me. And I'll enjoy that. I call that retirement. But anyway, some of us are going to make it. And, you know, I plan to make it. And, you know, but then if I don't, I don't. And no big deal. I made it 58 years. I might make it to 60. And then if it happens, it may happen this year. If it happens, it happens. And, you know, I was born with a guarantee I'm on the way out. So, mm-hmm. You know, I don't worry about that. And really, and we've only got a few minutes left. Let me get your response to what I said earlier. You know, it's like you hear a weather report. It says it's going to rain tomorrow. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. Now, what you do is you carry your umbrella in case it does. That way, you don't get soaked if it does. Everyone who said, those guys are always wrong. It's not going to rain. And then there's a Texas toad choker. They get flooded, you know, and they get sick. They get rained on and soaked inside out, and they get pneumonia and all that. You had your umbrella. Now, if you have your umbrella and it doesn't rain, what was the harm? None.
That's right.
So let me get your reaction to that.
All right. The thing is that I hear this conversation, and I hear it in two very different ways from two different groups of people. When I'm talking to, you know, Six-Pack Joe out on Main Street, it is, the conversation is already, it's always full of reticence. God, you know, I see it, but I don't want to really take responsibility for this, and then I got to do something that I really can't afford, and it's priorities, and if I start buying survival supplies, the wife isn't going to get her leather couch. She's going to rip my head off for that. Then I talk to people who are making enough money that they really enjoy the Bush tax cuts. And I'll tell you what they're doing with their Bush tax cuts. They're building bunkers, folks. And they don't go on with the hand twisting and the poor little me and gee, I'm reticent and what do I know and hoochie poochie and watchy watchy and let's get this theory and let's get that theory and hoocha 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 and it's nonsense and crap that they're doing. No, they're going, I'm building me a bunker. Entry level price, $500,000. Most of them millions to 2 million, and these guys, not only when they build them, they bring the crews in from 300 to 500 miles away because they don't want locals knowing how to dig them out. And you know what they ask me, my conversations with these people? They just want to know. They say, here is within 25 or 50 miles of where I am putting my bunker. This is the general geographic area. What do you think? And if I say on a scale of 1 to 10, it's an 8, 9, or a 10, they say, thank you very much. They buy a book, and they're gone like a fart in the breeze. The ones that are still sitting there with the oochki poochki smoking gun, la la cha 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 cha, are the people that I care the most about, and they're as dumb as a sack of hammers, a lot of them. And then there's a lot more of them, though, that are just as smart and savvy as the people who have the Bush tax cuts. They don't make enough to enjoy them, and they're out there doing it, baby. They are doing it. And I
at any income level, there is something, there are things you can do that will enhance survivability of any catastrophe, whether it's caused by El Niño or it's caused by a thunderstorm. You know, there are things you can do within any budget. Look, our audience knows what my budget is like. But, you know, a bag of beans and a bag of rice are not expensive. And the great thing about it is, you know, you stockpile some beans and rice, and you can rotate that stuff. I happen to like beans and rice, and so I buy it. And then, you know, after you know, so long, I go ahead and cook the oldest beans and rice before they really get too old, and I replace that, you know. So I go ahead and cook them, I eat them, and then I buy a new bag of beans and a new bag of rice. And it's not within any budget. There are things you can do to enhance survivability of any catastrophe. And so I don't think that that's... look, there are people out there who think if you plan for surviving catastrophe that you are some kind of wacko. I think since we know catastrophes are going to happen, we don't know when, we don't know where, but we know they are going to happen whether there's El Niño or not. I think if you're not prepared for it, that's wacko.
That's right. And saying, well, gee, when it happens, I'll just lay down and die, that is such a lame piece of garbage. It just gores my ox to hear people say it, because I got news for you. When the guacamole is hitting the fan, you're not going to sit there and say, well, 2 years ago I said, I'm going to die. No, you're going to be screaming, feet don't fail me now, and you're going to try and steal anything that you haven't gotten already, and you're going to be acting hysterical and stupid.
Yeah, so right now is the time to prepare. Marshall, I want to thank you for being with us again. You brought us some additional information, very interesting information, too, and useful information. And, folks, if you click his picture on my website, it'll take you to his website, and there's all kinds of information there. So avail yourself of that, okay? And, Marshall, if you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment as we bring this one in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. That's a wrap for this week. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.